Okay.
All right. Dude, it is so great to be talking with you, man. Cam and I, we love your stuff. We're huge fans. And I looked at you, I was like, man, this guy's brother from another mother. Belmar, New Jersey.
Here, that's right.
Let's go. Okay, so all my best strength coach friends are all from Jersey. You know, Zach Evanesh, he's down in the Jersey Shore. And yep. And it's they got a great culture and a great history of just meathead shit down there in Jersey. It's so good.
True. Zach is maybe 2 miles down the road from where I'm sitting right now. We bump into each other at like with our kids at the coffee shop and like it's all small town stuff. But yes, we are meatheads down here, like born and raised in gyms. It's like that's a part of it. There's no like bar mitzvahs down here. There's no like, you know, crossing of the you know, oak tree or whatever. You go to the gym. You're especially as like young boys.
Cops are to Staten Island what meatheads are to New Jersey.
Exactly. So we got Joe DeFranco, who's maybe about 45 minutes from here. We are thick, you know, with a lot of good strength-minded, you know, just coaches out here and athletes and whatnot.
All right. So we'll start this officially. What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of the Love and Thunder podcast. You guys may have figured it out. We got a special celebrity trainer guest host today. Mike Dolce from the Dolce Diet. Cam and I are huge fans and supporters of Mike, and we're so stoked to have you here on the show. Multiple time voted best MMA trainer in the universe best-selling author of the Dolce Diet, has touched tons and tons of people and really done a lot of cool stuff. Mike, welcome to the show, dude.
Guys, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on and the ability to just chat, you know, with like-minded individuals here. So I'm excited to have the conversation and to, you know, your amazing audience. Thank you for allowing me into your lives.
So for those of you guys that don't know, Mike, he's a bit of a specialist, obviously a trainer, but super knowledgeable when it comes to nutrition. And as Cam and I have been like watching your content over the years and reading your stuff, we can't help but notice so many of the parallels between our methodologies and yours and even our stories. You know, you're a guy, you were a power lifter, then you got into MMA and you kind of went into that realm of elite athletic performance, which is so similar to us, right? Former professional baseball, trained my wife to be the CrossFit Games champion. Thank you very much.
Whoa.
She did the lifting, but I was the puppeteer, Mike.
You know, she... don't give yourself too much credit there. I put the work in.
It's interesting, and I see this with a lot of coaches, guys that you mentioned, Joe DeFranco, Zach Evanesh, ourselves and you. You kind of start in this realm of like, hey, I will do whatever it takes to get those inches as an athlete. You know what I mean? Like within the rules of the game, everything I can do to dial it in to be my very best. And then you kind of go through this evolution of learning and discovering that everybody needs this stuff, not just elite athletes.
Yes. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your story and how you ended up where you are.
Man, so my story is, I mean, long. I mean, how long is this show? We got about
4 minutes. I don't know. Let's just keep going. I don't care. I'm canceling my client. I'm going to text my clients. They're canceled.
You know, I started as a wrestler, right? High school wrestler, traditional folk style, amateur wrestling. And I was fortunate that I was a 4-year varsity captain as a high school athlete. And hey, that's kind of rare. Right. You don't really see a 13-year-old freshman, the captain of a varsity team, telling the seniors what to do and running them through drills. And I had an aptitude for coaching and for leadership, but also I had a pretty solid grasp of the science because I was fully immersed in it. You know, I was an honors science and an honors math guy. I was kind of like a buff nerd in a way. It's like that was my thing. But since I was 8 years old, I started lifting weights in my basement, kind of, you know, traditional story, maybe. I was just enamored with it. Arnold Schwarzenegger and I grew up in like the Rocky, Van Damme, you know, kind of Arnold type of era of action hero. And that was like larger than life. So I was pulled into that, you know, wrestling, you know, I blew out my shoulder my senior year. I couldn't quite go on to the next level, which was the whole goal. And I transitioned into powerlifting. So I went from one weight class oriented sport at the extreme to the other. And I went and competed all the way up from like 181 all the way up to super heavyweight, weighing 282 pounds as a powerlifter, right? So I started wrestling at 114 and then all the way up to 282 and all, and like every weight class in between. And then after powerlifting, I'll speed through the story. I started training because I had the urge to get back. Like my wrestling career was unresolved, right? Could I have been an All-American? How good could I have I've been? Because I had some Division I scholarship offers at that time, and I never got to see what would happen. And I walked into a jiu-jitsu school. And this is back in the late 90s, right? And I just started training with those guys, and immediately it all clicked in. And they really gravitated towards me again in my knowledge base in this coaching. I was there as a student, and all of a sudden I'm coaching now all these black belts, and I'm a white belt in jiu-jitsu and combat. And this is back when it's still considered NHB, no holds barred fighting, and it's banned on pay-per-view and, yep, and all that. And of course I'm like, oh, well, this is great. I'm going to go all in on this little niche sport that'll probably never make it. And I'm going to build a career here where these guys can't afford to pay me. Yeah. You know, it's, I mean, perfect business model, right? Yeah.
And that's exactly us with CrossFit, yeah, way back in the day. We were laughing. We totally get it.
People, we're filming ourselves training in a dingy garage. And like, how are people even interested in this? You know,
and it's funny because like I have such fond memories of those early days of MMA and the UFC, where it was really, it was for the love of the training and self-development and testing ourselves and like the room. Like the people sweating and bleeding in that room with you, and like the bonds that were built, it wasn't about the fanfare now of all the money and the prestige and the social media followers, right? Yeah. I mean, it was about just the purity of the work, and that's what really drew me to it. So I had a career in real estate finance. I was a math guy, right? So I worked as a municipal tax assessor, property valuation and you know, property taxes and all that stuff. And I hated it. Absolutely. I hated putting on a suit and sitting in a corner office and all that stuff. And I'd take the train from, you know, here, Long Branch, New Jersey, not far, hour and a half train ride to New York City. I'd go and train with Henzo Gracie and all of his amazing athletes up there in New York City, take the train back home. I get home at midnight, and I have to be awake at 6 o'clock in the morning to put the stupid suit back on and go back to the office. And I got in, you know, keep fast forwarding. And back in 2004, I got an offer from Randy Couture, who I had met him and his team at just some of these, you know, fight events working with the Henzo guys. And they offered me to come out there and spend 3 days with them. And that turned into a job offer to be the head strength coach of Team Quest North in 2004, which was the number one fight team in the entire world. And I don't know a lot of other sports, maybe the LA Lakers, the New York Yankees, I don't know, the Kansas City Chiefs, right? Team Quest was that dominant team, mm-hmm, the number one team in the world. And they offered me the job as a head strength coach because my reputation had started to grow behind the scenes and on the old school message boards and with athletes I had worked with. And I resigned that position as a municipal tax assessor. I took this job, and literally I was offered a job at 10% of the salary I was making, right? So, oh, that's another great business decision. Sure.
Yeah.
Let me do that job. I probably won't be able to feed my family, but hey, took that job. And then my career really took off from there in the MMA space, where I went there though, guys, as a strength coach. Now, old school Jersey Shore meathead, right? Strength coach. And when I got there, I realized it was the nutrition that differentiated me.
Yeah.
And that's how I really pulled away from all of it. Because there's a lot of great strength coaches. I mean, you named a few. A lot of great strength coaches in this world. Unfortunately, at that time, and even today, maybe we'll get into it, there are very few talented and experienced nutrition coaches, specifically in all spaces, but very much so in the combat sports space, where the athletes have to cut weight.
It's like being a 5-tool player. Like, you may see someone who's outstanding in the training side of things, but, you know, maybe due to a lack of practice or interest, or maybe they just instead outsource to a guy they know, where it's like he knows more than I do, just do his stuff. They don't take time to develop that facet of their coaching game.
But also, I mean, I've done, you know, cut in weightlifting a lot. And yeah. I think you're absolutely right when it comes to losing weight, but keeping your, you know, your muscle contraction capacity, keeping like the right, you know, type of glycogen in your muscle when you're refeeding before your weightlifting or your match or, you know, whatever it is. I've seen coaches, like the biggest thing they do when they try to cut people, they only look at the weight.
Yeah.
They're like, we just need your weight to come down. And it's like, there's so much more than that. And there's ways to do it where we can target the fat and keeping as much musculature and capacity as possible. And it has to be done well. And it can be done, you know, 3 days before. And there's just so many ways. And I mean, I couldn't agree more with you. And I think it's a huge, even looking back at when I did CrossFit, I feel like I developed so much more knowledge now that I'm, you know, kind of specializing in body transformation with all ages. Because now I look very specifically at the state of their body, anabolic, catabolic, and how their hormones react and what type of training or food, what, you know, that triggers in their hormones, which I never did when I was competing. Because the thought behind when you're an elite athlete is almost, it's kind of putting the carbs as the hero, and it really shouldn't be. There is a context for the carbs and a place and a time, but it shouldn't always be in your system where your insulin is always elevated and you always have inflammation. And I truly wish I had all this knowledge back then, and I truly wish I might have worked with someone like you back then. So, yeah, tell us more about that because I'm so excited.
Mike,
I love that stuff.
Mike, I love hearing you talk about like the glory days. This reminds me of like when we got into CrossFit, it wasn't big yet. Like nobody knew about it. Nobody cared about it. It's like bowling, you know, like an underground kind of, you know.
The prize was a Panda Express like gift card or something like that.
And it was so raw. You'd go into these CrossFit gyms. It was like CrossFit hepatitis with like nails coming out of the wall and blood and vomit on the floor. And like, it was just so... It was like Fight Club, you know, and it was for love of the game, for the passion of what you do. And I think that's the thing is like for guys like you and me and Cam and a lot of our athletes, man, you just get addicted to the lifestyle when you have tasted what it is to be an elite athlete and to be chasing that thing. And just, you know, every day is on purpose with purpose and pushing towards a goal. And then when you get done with your sport, that's over. And you're like, who am I? What now? You know, and you find these things. And I think that that's where that passion really comes out is that process driven kind of pursuit for some people. They just need that.
Yeah. Well, I believe that we all need purpose as humans. Right. And I speak a lot to men, you know, being a man, it's much easier for me to speak to them and the needs of men in the voice of a man and how many men they lose purpose over time. And I call them the soft-handed males. They seek a life of pleasure, right? They think pleasure. They want to retire in their 20s. They want to just sit around coffee shops and eat avocado toast and sip soy lattes. They don't want to get calluses on their hands, right? You know, and that's the wrong way to go about it. And they are the most maladjusted and depressed humans on the planet. It is the human, the individual that gets up every day and toils with a purpose that matters most. I mean, you guys know the amount of work that you put in, the pain, the suffering, the injuries that you have to deal with because you have this greater purpose that you look back fondly at the struggle. Right. And that's what we need. Like, I need a reason to get out of bed every morning when it's cold and dark outside and I'm sore and tired and scared and lonely. Like, I need a reason to get out of bed every fucking day. And that purpose has to be bigger. And it's like, yes, we have families. And a lot of this is a homage to the family to protect and provide for our families, but also to lead them. It's to show my children that life is discomfort and we have to embrace that. And then seeking pursuits that are uncomfortable so we can unlock our greater self And I think that's what CrossFit sounds like for you, and you know, fighting and martial arts and such is for me. But then when that career is over, because I fought, you know, I have almost 50 fights, 30 some odd professional fights, right? And, you know, and I understand that. And all of a sudden my ego is tied into my win-loss record and how well I do and, you know, how I look on stage. All this crap, it's tied into like these accomplishments. And you start to lose in a way, and this happens to a lot of the athletes, all athletes, you start to lose the purity of what got you started, because it's all the fanfare, the spectacle, it's the ranking, it's your competitors and your sponsorships and your endorsement, how much you're getting paid, and this one's screwing me and that one could be better. All this crap, right? The parallels are great. It dilutes it. And the best thing for me is I had a fork in my road where I was still the head strength coach. And I only started fighting, one is so I can better understand the confines of performance to be a better coach to my athletes. Mm-hmm. And also because I was broke and I needed to go fight in a cage in a strip club to make $500 just so I could pay bills, right? Hopefully my stitches cost less than the amount of money I made. And like, I started doing that, and I was fortunate that I was entertaining, and I wasn't great per se. I was more like a journeyman fighter, but yep. I was fighting way above my pay grade. I was fighting world champions because I was in great shape. I was tough as shit, and I was able. I had good wrestling. I had a lot of from powerlifting. I had one touch knockout power, which everybody wanted to see. Right. So
wait a second. No, you had the fastest knockout ever in, was it IFC?
History? In ISL. Yeah, IFL. Yeah, yeah. Back in 2000.
How fast was it?
It was,
you just go
14 seconds.
There we go. Oh, wow. Pretty quick.
14 seconds. And yeah, it back, you know, that was, I mean, that's one of like, a standout moment in my career because it was on television. It was on like WPIX back in those days, Channel 11, which was like,
oh yeah. It was right between the Nobody Beats the Wiz commercials.
Exactly. So it was like, man, and back in those days, I was making a lot of money for a fighter back in those days, right? So it's like, wow, like I'm actually doing it. I got onto the Ultimate Fighter TV show. I'm making, you know, good money. I don't have to, quote, work anymore. I'm still working as a strength coach and now a diet coach and all that. And I had a crossroads in my career where I actually sat back and I looked at myself and I was like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Like, am I just going to keep chasing this shrine to my ego here and trying to become like, I'm never going to be a UFC world champion. Yeah. I understand that. I don't have the time. I'm already in my, you know, early mid 30s now. I started fighting. I only started when I was 28 years old. So I was old when I got in per se. Yeah. I didn't have the pedigree of all these young kids coming in and these, you know, Division I national champions, jiu-jitsu world champions, and Muay Thai world. I didn't have the pedigree.
And so I bet you it was getting better and better every year as the sport gains popularity and more pedigree athletes start being attracted. I mean, it's the same thing in CrossFit, right? You know, when we started, there weren't very many uber elite athletes. You know, a couple of people who had paid Division I sports. And now, you know, you get a lot of people that are just freak athletes that get exposed to the sport. So the level rises.
Yeah. And you know, it's, we saw that. And it's funny because I was coaching that. So when I got to Team Quest, I have a business background. I looked at their business model. I was like, oh, wait, I gotta change this. We need a kids program. We need a women's program. We need a pro shop. We need an online presence. And I developed all that. I brought in their 401k program. I bought in like, you know, automated, you know, payroll and their EFT processor and like memberships and signups and all this. I brought all that stuff in. They didn't have any of that.
So it wasn't like drop your dues in the piggy bank at the end of the month.
That's the way it was.
Yes, exactly.
Like, so very like, I mean, old school.
You remember. Oh, I remember that. There used to be a sign up sheet, a little clipboard. Be like, yeah, you let me look. Oh yeah, you owe $100. You know, drop it.
Then you're chasing these dudes around for cash. Like CrossFit guys and gals, fighters have no money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They got no money. I mean, they're trying, like everyone's trying to make ends meet. It's not tennis. It's not golf, right? It is not a rich kid's sport. Chris Lieben, one of my good friends, you know, very famous UFC fighter, now retired. He had said back in those Team Quest days, he's looking around and we're all just standing around about to like go grab lunch, and we're just all ugly and beat up and bruises and scars. And he's like, what are we doing? He's like, you know, he's like, I've come to realize that male fighters are the equivalent to female strippers. We're all fucked up in the head. Right? We all got this issue going on. Like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this to ourselves? And we show up every day for more of this pain and trauma. Like, what are we doing here? I was kind of that always resonated because we always had a chip on our shoulder. We're always trying to prove something. Mm-hmm. Right. And it wasn't about the fanfare. It was more because nobody's watching the training. Yeah. Right. Very few people at that time were even watching the fights. So it was about proving something to ourselves, becoming a better version of ourselves. And I think in a way, we all felt that we needed to suffer for that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had to endure a lot of that pain in order to break free to the next level.
Yeah. And you look back, like you said, you look back on that stuff so fondly. I think like a lot of times as athletes, we get so attached mm-hmm. to the specifics of the sport, you know, like, you know, my record or, you know, how good I was as a fighter. But the truth is you're developing skills and using the sport as a vessel to express those skills. And you can take those skills beyond your sport and use them in your business, in your family, in your life. I mean, it's just that process of, you know, push, assess, adjust, and again, and again, and again. Like that's really the thing. And I think a lot of people, when they're done, they kind of give up sometimes and they're like, well, that's it for me. No reason to push that hard.
I'm tired of pushing.
But you really chop your legs out from under you in terms of your potential and your happiness, I think, because you're totally right. Like you do need that purpose-driven life where you feel you're making your minutes count on this earth and you're working towards something, not just hanging out, waiting for, you know, mailing it in, waiting for the clock to run down. Mike, I wanted to get into a little bit more of the nutrition stuff with you, because I know you've got some fantastic stuff out there that's not just exclusive for elite athletes, but really everyone should know about. Tell us a little bit about your mantra and how it's developed with regard to nutrition over the years.
Well, we take a longevity approach to nutrition. So if we focus on the end result, the short term becomes very easy. Yeah. I want to be 120 years old. I believe the science is there. Medical is there. There's, you know, all the things we need is there. Potentially, we should all be able to make it if we don't mess it up along the way and outside any genetic variabilities. And of course, but there's others who have gotten that far. Therefore, why can't we? And with the knowledge we have today, why aren't we at least trying?
It's like the 4-minute mile, right? If one person can do it, now all of a sudden a lot of other people can do it. And I think we're in such an exciting time now where a lot of these technologies or just information is so widely accessible and available for people more than ever before.
Absolutely. Mike, you talk a lot about, and I can relate so much to the suffering when it comes to being in a gym, right? Yeah. And I think, you know, something I've realized over the year, and maybe because I just love to push myself in every direction, is that a lot of people, they have kind of this misconception, in my mind at least, of what kind of that mental fortitude and toughness is, because they are comfortable doing this one thing that to someone else will seem like mental toughness, right? You have those people that are completely addicted to, you know, running long distance, or for me, it was doing CrossFit, right? It was like, oh, she's so mentally tough, but it was like this weird relationship of punishing myself in some ways and trying to see what I was made of, where truly the mental toughness for me was being able to pull back, or even more like really being disciplined with my nutrition. That is my true nemesis. That's really hard for me. And I think that people have no issue putting that discipline in when it comes to certain aspect of their life, but not the other one. And I think nutrition is a big one on that side, where like they're mentally tough until you take the cake and the beer away.
That's true. We have a saying is how you do one thing is how you do everything. So if you've proven to be mentally tough in one area of life, you can then use that same toughness and point it at every other area, but it becomes a choice. And many times people find excuses or they find ways out, or they're just simply looking for a pressure release, right?
Yeah.
Going off the rails somehow makes them feel like they're in control,
yes,
while at the same time, they're actually doing self-harm.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting conversation, and I've broken it down to the hug concept. And I like to say, mm-hmm, that we do what we do today because of hugs. It's because of the hug that we got when we did not deserve it, creating this entitled mentality, or it's the hug we did not get when we did deserve it or need it.
Yeah.
That puts this, right? Chip, yeah, on our shoulder and fort, like, I'll show them, I'll do this. And sometimes it's like, I'll push myself off the cliff. I'm going to fucking crash and burn, yeah, just to show that person in my life 10, 20, 30 years ago that they were wrong or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Like, so, and it's all different for all of us. And I think as I say this, every person listening, they're like, you remember an instant in your life where that makes sense. So yeah, now it's today. What do we do about that? Well, what's your goal? What are you trying to accomplish? And also, I like to say that we all have demons inside of us. And that is a good thing. To pretend that we don't is a lie, and it's self-destructive.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is we need to reach down deep into our soul. We need to grab that demon by the hand. We need to pull it out, expose it to the world, embrace it, address it. But at the same time, I'm in control. I'm holding its hand, and I'm still walking in the direction that I'm choosing with my demon next to me now. Like, yeah, I know the demon is there. I know it exists. I know my history. I know my flaws. And in spite of that, I'm still controlling my path moving forward without hiding it. And many people try and hide their fears, their insecurities, their vulnerabilities. And that is one of the fatal weaknesses many athletes suffer while,
yes,
using martial arts. If you're not good at wrestling and you're really good at striking and you avoid the wrestlers and you avoid wrestling training, well, what happens?
Yeah.
A mediocre wrestler is going to take you down and beat your ass.
Yeah. And I mean, I look back at my career when I was more immature and younger, and I would hear myself say things like, oh, the program was against me or whatever. And that lasted that didn't last long with me.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like if you're able to look at yourself and hear yourself, and I heard myself saying that, and I was like, oh my God, you know, there's no such thing. Is like, you have weakness and you have to attack them. And I couldn't agree more with you, because that's something we hear people say all the time. And you know, one of the thing that triggers me somehow the most, and I think it triggers me because I've heard myself say that in the past, and I kind of hate that younger version of me, kind of that, you know, little demon that was there back then. But I'll see people writing things like, I worked so hard and I didn't end up where my work, you know, it wasn't representative of my work. And to me, it's like, well, you're very selfish because you're discarding the fact that everyone else worked harder than you.
This is the post screwing the pooch dissertation you see on Instagram, where, yeah, you're like, as soon as you see the script, you're like, oh, Jesus,
yeah,
Christ,
I've never
here we
done
go.
That.
You wrote a fucking book because you shit the bed and you need to take ownership of it. Instead, it's going to be all about who didn't do what and why it's not your fault, yeah, and this, that, and the other thing.
But I've always struggled with someone saying it's not representative of my work, because that is completely false. Everything you do when you're in the arena is exactly representative of your work. You are either overtrained, which I was some year. You were ill prepared. You didn't attack your weakness. That is all on you. But I think like the part that annoys me on the flip side is, and again, I've been that person and I'm just older now. Mm-hmm. I see it more for what it is. But it's when you discard the work of other people. And that was the biggest slap in my face. Going from year, and that was the year before I won the CrossFit game. That was that huge slap that like kind of lit that much needed fire under me. is that I thought I was the hardest worker in the room. And then I showed up and I realized that everyone else was willing to suffer more than me or as much as me. And I was like, oh God, I am so far from what I thought I was. And I think it's important to notice those things. Every time you think you're the hardest worker, you're not. Trust me, there's a lot of people that work way harder in much more horrible condition.
These are complicated conversations to have with your wife, Mike.
I get it. I'll talk to your wife. You come over here and talk to my wife, right? Because I'm the last person she wants to hear.
And that's right.
I mean, within
like, you have a relationship. You have a relationship with a friend or a family. Like, you got to draw that line between, you know, this is you, the coach, not you, the loving friend or family member. You know, it's, I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. I'm going to tell you what you need to hear. And that's a complicated line to navigate. But I wanted to go back to something you were saying is like, man, like Cam brought it up. We work with a population of people that love messing themselves up in the gym. Like, they'll do pull-ups until their fucking hands bleed. They'll condition until they're hypoxic and they puke. But the second a diet becomes a little bit challenging, you see them throwing their arms up in the air and they go, oh my God, I'm hungry. Or I just can't eat the food is too boring or this and that. And it's been a challenge for us over the years to figure out how to really frame nutrition for people and give it its due diligence and importance. Because for us, the nutrition component for what most people are coming to us or probably to you for, like, hey, I want to transform my body. I want to live my longest, best life. Like, it's probably more important than the training. Yeah. When you think about the way it's going to influence your internal chemistry and turn on certain signals in your body, I'm like, it doesn't, you know, training programs, they're generally very similar once you're within the realm of certain categories. But for nutrition, it's the kind of thing where it's not given enough respect, especially at the foundational level. And so when people do it for real the first time and see the results, that's usually the switch that flips. They're like, holy shit, I've been operating at a fraction of my potential for so long. And I just thought if I just train hard and eat pretty good, I'll get to where I need to be.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting construct of the general population in that they all want to be rich and sexy, but nobody wants to save their money and diet or take care of their bodies, right? So they want this thing that they refuse to do the things necessary to get those things, and they meander through mediocrity for the entirety of their lives, and they make excuses as to why they can't. You know, I'm sure you guys, like I, you know, I work with some of the rich and famous people that do have personal assistants and private chefs, and they end up on movie screens or TV or whatever it might be. And, you know, I'll get people that say, oh, well, it must be nice for them to have someone cooking all their meals for them. So I cook all my meals.
Yeah.
Takes me like an hour a week, 30 minutes twice a week. You know, I'll make my own breakfast and, you know, we'll eat a normal dinner like every other family in America. But for the most part, crock pot chicken, baked potatoes, rice, easy stuff. So what we try and do is, number one, like one-on-one with clients, we'll use motivational interviewing, and we're trying to get our clients to express what their goal is, what their challenges are, and what the solution is. Where I don't want to tell them, I want to curate the conversation so they start to peel back the layer and they understand what their challenges are. And most people will be like, oh my, you'll see them have these eurekas in the moment. And that allows them to more buy into the overall program, because now it's their idea per se, instead of, you just need to eat chicken and rice, fat ass.
Yeah.
Like, you just need to stop drinking beer. That's not going to work. But if they're like, hey, you know, why are you here? I'm looking to lose weight. Why are you looking to lose weight? I don't feel really good in my body. Why don't you feel really good in my body? My clothes don't fit well anymore. I'm really tired. I'm sluggish, and this and the other's going on. Thing. Why do you think that is? Well, I probably drink a little bit too much. I eat a little bit too much. What do you think would be a good way to resolve this? I should probably stop drinking on Thursday, Friday night. I probably should start bringing my lunch. That is a great idea. I'd be happy to help you come up with a meal plan.
Yeah.
That fits your goals. Like, great idea. Wow, you're a genius. You thought of it. I got some cool meal plans you'll probably like. Let's match these to you. getting people to buy into the program is important, but also as coaches, we must understand, and this is hard for me because I'm very empathetic. I think all great coaches are. Like, I go on this emotional journey with my clients, and I had to realize that I cannot help everyone, and I have to say no, and I can't go on this journey of self-destruction with you.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, because we're all going to get frustrated here. Me and Dave, every client that we work with, one of the things we tell them is that if we're not able to like get that, you know, get into that journey with them and make a change, that we're going to fire our own self. So I tell all my clients, if I realize that we're not moving forward, I'm not the right person for you, and I'm going to fire myself.
It's a reverse way of firing the client, Mike. If you do everything I say, exactly how I say it, and it doesn't work, I'm going to fire myself. And then when they don't do
it, well, because
they lie to you and they say, oh, I'm doing it.
No,
right?
But as another example, even if they did truly everything I said and it didn't work, I'm not the right person for them.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's maybe like a skill that I haven't acquired, and I don't have so much of an ego that I think that I know everything about everything, but it's like, you did everything I said, and this is all the knowledge I have up to this point of in my life, and it's not working. My God, please go work with someone that maybe have like, a bigger background in endocrine side or, you know, something else that obviously I'm not able to help you with, because I'm doing myself and yourself a disservice.
The other part of that is when you work with a client, you're also putting your name on that person.
Yes.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, that's a representation of you and your passion. And we tell them like, hey, we got you, bro. Like, we're going to take all the decisions out of your hands. You don't need to know what to eat, when to eat, how much to eat. We're going to tell you exactly all that. And all you got to do is run the plays. Yep. And now it just takes those opportunities to mess it up out of their hands to some degree. Right. But it also puts a lot of onus on us where it's like, hey, you know, we want to make sure that for all that we're investing in, do we have an equivalent investment from the client? Do they really want it? You know, because if they don't, that's kind of a roadblock you're not going to get around.
No, it's true. If they don't want it, if they're not willing to do the work, there's nothing more that we can do other than wish them the best and say, we're here when you're ready.
Yes.
Yep.
And release them. And that opens up a spot for someone who is ready. Yeah. And that's the person I want to go all in and invest my time and my heart into and walk the journey. It's why, in a way, I walked away from all these athletes. You know, I kind of retired from working with the pro athletes back in 2015, the birth of my first daughter. I wanted to be a present father, not so much a stay-at-home father, but I mean, I'm there all day, every day, and I'm a half a mile from my front door where I'm sitting here in my office, right?
Oh, there's nothing better than being a girl dad, Mike. It's the best.
How many do you guys have?
We have our little daughter, Zoe, and she's our little miracle. We almost lost her when she was born. She was born very early.
Yep.
And now she is this ball of energy, combination of Camille and I. She's like super serious like Camille, but she gets completely out of hand like me. And,
awesome.
And she is such a sweet wild, little being, man. She lights me up, and I think like as a guy, you know, I thought when Cam was pregnant, I thought I wanted a boy. I'm like, oh, what a boy, he'll be just like me. Yep. And then when we found out it was a girl, I was like thrown back a little bit. I was like, okay. And then I started thinking, oh, this is going to be great. It's going to be like a little version of Camille. Yep. And it's just been such a beautiful, wonderful experience getting to be her dad so far. I mean, it just lights me up in ways I can't even describe.
That's it. I mean, girl dads, we know, we understand there is a part in our heart that we would never have had access to without having a daughter in our life. And that changed me, you know, changed yourself completely, where I thought like, hey, I'm a man, I'm like, you know, boys, and I'm going to grow them up to be like these masculine, you know, burly, take over the world. And now I have these daughters and I still want them to take over the world, while still being these just beautiful, feminine little ladies. It's all rainbows and unicorns around our house, right? That's all. Yeah. But the gymnastics and martial arts, were about to get him into judo and, like, you know, all the STEM science protocols and, like, engineering. It's like, man, violins and pianos. It's like, just like to see the world through your daughter's eyes changes everything, right? And even, I think you talk about purpose. Now, my purpose as a man, as a father, as a husband, as a community leader, as a businessman, as a protector, provider, it's, I understand everything I do, my daughters watch and judge, and I want that pressure on me. So I'm only judging myself now by how will my daughters judge me for this word I may speak or this behavior I may exhibit, for this habit that I have. Like, they're going to look back 20, 40, 60 years from now at dad, and I want that image to be the best possible image. I can't say perfect, but I'm doing my damnedest to make sure through their eyes I am. But I also, when I run my business, I do it that way too.
Yep.
I make sure that I want to leave a legacy. I want to leave a reputation. I want to leave something that they can take over when they're 18, 25, if they choose to do so. They're already working on our business now in their capacity, but the ability for them to take the helm one day, well, yep, that's kind of what I'm trying to build.
Building and generational wealth, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And giving them that purpose and understanding. And I really want them to know, and we you know, I educate them that we are helping people. That's what mommy and daddy do, because my wife runs the behind the scenes. Yeah. We help people. What do? We help people. We help people live better lives. We help people be healthy. So when they eat the way we eat, like in our household, is not just to keep my daughters healthy, but it's also to teach them the lessons that they will later be able to teach their circle of influence in life and allow that to spread. So a lot of it's all baked in. And I think I said earlier, it's like, you know, we need purpose, and family, yes, is purpose, but also it's like when I come here to work or when I'm in the gym or out, you know, putting miles on the road, like it's all the same thing. Like, yeah, it all leads to that one overall outcome. And, you know, to those listening, we said it's how you do one thing, it's how you do everything. So when I want a piece of carrot cake and I choose to have the crock pot chicken and the sweet potato and the grilled asparagus or whatnot instead, and I say, you know what, I love carrot cake. I could eat it all day, every day, but I haven't earned it yet.
Yeah.
And I can do without it because I have a greater purpose right now. Like, I haven't achieved my goal. I have not, and I use the term earned. I haven't earned it yet. I haven't put in enough work to earn that yet. And I like to delay gratification as far as possible, which steals my own reserve. Like, I could do it right now. Nobody's going to know. I'm still going to have abs tomorrow, right? No one's going to know, but I'll know. And that little bit of daylight that I'm giving myself, well, that door, we all know, you can kick that door. Once there's daylight, that door can swing wide open. So the longer I can keep that door closed, the more in control I am of the lock. And with that, it's like I could go months without a piece of carrot cake, although I've well earned it. And this is what I try and teach to my clients also, because when I speak with them, I need them to believe me. And yeah. If I'm not living what I'm telling them, they're going to feel it. So I have to be fully transparent and forthright and honest. So at 11 o'clock at night when the family's sleeping and I'm standing in my kitchen and I can eat whatever I want, nobody will ever know.
Looking at the chocolate chips.
Right? Yeah, but I know. And so it's like it's there and everyone faces that.
Yeah.
But Mike, you know. And I think that's enough. And like, so a lot of this is gamifying it. How can I gamify this to keep myself accountable?
Yes, that's what I was going to say. I feel like the way I see it now, you know, coming from a professional athlete, those are the games I play with myself now. Yeah. It's like, oh, you think you're tough? Okay. Like, are you able to do that? Like that specifically, because to me, that is the hardest thing. I can train all day, all night. I can, like, I'm a full workaholic if I let myself be, but it's like, can I fuel myself in a healthy, reasonable way without punishing myself for it, where everything is now in balance and healthy? And I love what you say with the light, because to me, like the two things I tell myself is, one, I have to build that edge. You have to build that edge again, like against those insulin spikes. So when they come in, the effect is minimal. And it's like the more edge you can build, the more minimal the effect is going to be when you fall off. And the other one is really the devil's in the detail. So every time you allow 1 inch, then it becomes 2 inch. And all of a sudden your life spiraled down and you're like, how did this happen? And it was like literally that handful of chocolate chip every night.
Mike, I think we're always, whether we know it or not, we're always training ourselves, right? And we're either training ourselves to win and to persevere, or we're training ourselves to quit and to give in. And one of the things that I like, just with all of our athletes, with ourselves, like the biggest skill that I think is so valuable in every aspect of your life is discipline and probably courage too, right? And like, you know, courage is putting your ass on the line. Discipline is keeping your ass in line. Yeah. And they're both perishable skills, right? Because when you stop practicing them, they go away. Like you said, you take the cake that one day and now you're like, oh, it's okay. And one day becomes 2 days and 3 days. And before you know it, there's no discipline. You're not establishing those rules that you have for yourself, delaying what you want right now for what you want for yourself long-term. And it's not being mean to yourself. It's actually being loving and kind to yourself. And that's something we try to talk about with our athletes when we're being hard on them. We're saying, you got to dial it up. I need more out of you. You know, you got to stop mailing it in. It's not because we're trying to be mean. It's because we want them to honor that person they know they want to be, that person they aspire to be.
Yeah. Again, that's what a great coach does. We see in the athlete something much greater than they can yet see in themselves. Yeah. And it is our job for them to see that, but they won't see that until they get there. And they only get there once they put in that work. They have to do things they do not yet believe they're capable of and see themselves as this greater version of themselves, because every athlete is talented in their own special way. But when they look across the playing field, they see another great athlete and a pile of great, and like, oh my God, look at her, look at him, look at what they can do. And that's intimidating, and we're human and we're vulnerable in that. But that same person is looking at them or at you, Camille, and saying, oh my God, look at her. Like, you see what she's done. I can't do what she does. And I got to put on my tough face and act like I'm not intimidated by that, right? And we all go through this. Yeah. And I'll go back to nutrition, where you talk about honing the discipline. What do we do more than anything else in our day that allows us more touch points to enhance the discipline? And that's eat, right? Yeah. Like most people like to train, and we can go to the gym and we can train, and training is relative to the individual. How far can you push, right? Yep. You guys can push much farther than the average person, but relative, you can push the same. Your level of volume and intensity is much higher. Your threshold is higher, but the average weekend warrior per se, hey man, just they broke a sweat. And that's kind of the extent of their threshold right now. But every single one of us, we're eating 3, 4, 5 times per day. How many times can you do that in a row to enhance that discipline or to steel your fortitude? So to me, nutrition allows me the greatest possible compounding factor in doing every other activity in my life. So and that's, again, I gamify it, right? Because for me, we said earlier, nutrition is vastly more important than our training. And you know, I'm a meathead. You guys are meatheads, but we understand. And people say, oh, that's not true. Training is this and that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Go eat donuts and Coca-Cola and, you know, go run a half marathon, go run a 20K, right? Let's go see what your split times are as compared to when you're fueling a different, whatever it might be. Now let's talk about post-workout nutrition. Let's talk about muscle protein synthesis. Let's talk about energy substrate utilization. Let's talk about the impact of digestive inflammation or gastritis or all of these other cofactors. Or how about, all right, now you're zinc deprived for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, or iron or magnesium deprived. your vitamin D3 is down in your toes. Let's talk about how that affects your career over time. How hard you train. You're going to be sick all the time. You're going to be injured all the time. You're going to have a higher body fat percentage relative to your muscle mass. You're not going to be able to have the same force, the same velocity, move the same weight, all that stuff. So we understand. But once nutrition is set, then everything else compounds.
100%.
Right? So it's like, if you can just get your nutrition in line, you'll yield a much greater multiple from training than without. So for the average person who might not, aspire to win the CrossFit games, they just want to look good on the beach and live long and be healthy, right? Not sit in a rocking chair at 60 years old with a stent in their heart, right?
It's still the same concept because that's the biggest thing I really wish. Because I was so obsessed with obviously the training and CrossFit, I think is similar in MMA in a way that it's like a puzzle to solve, right?
Yeah.
I have those skill in certain aspect of my sport. And it's like, how do I make myself as good as possible in the other skill while still being the best at my specific skill? So for me, it was kind of like gymnastic and weightlifting, but it was like, how do I bring my endurance high enough that I can be a top 5, top 10 athlete while destroying everyone still in the gymnastic? And that was like the constant puzzle to be solved. And I started to take the nutritional approach because I got so sick after my daughter was born, because I spent 12 weeks at the NICU and it completely destroyed my health. Oh, wow. And now it's like what I realized with nutrition is if I control the hormonal signal in my body through like nutrients timing and the type of food I eat, I control everything that's happening in my body. I control when I want to put muscle on, when I want to lean out, when I want to, have more fuel that supports certain type of training, depending on what type of energy system I'm in. And now, it's really mind-blowing how you can look at nutrition, and if you can control like all those like hormonal response, you control everything. Yeah. And I'm so fascinated by it, and I really wish I had that. And gosh, everyone who works with you are so lucky to get someone who understands that.
Yeah, we talk to people about like these three pillars. We're like, it all comes down to training, nutrition, and your lifestyle. And without it, the tripod falls over, right? You got to have them all in line. But I want to go back to what we were talking about with discipline, because I feel like a lot of people, they try to sidestep that. And what they'll do, and we notice this a lot, is like, okay, the people that ask the most questions are the ones that are the least compliant. So it's like, it's like telling somebody to jump off the edge of a cliff and they go, which way should I jump? Should I jump that way or that way? Should I do 2 feet or 1 foot? I saw this guy that did a backflip and then another guy that did it in the Speedo. Should I do it in the Speedo? And the way I see that happening with nutrition is these people, and it's true with training too, they program hop. They go from this program to that program or from this diet to that diet. And they're looking for that easy pill because they think, well, if I just do this, it'll click. Or they want to give themselves an excuse where they say, if I just do X, then I can still do whatever the hell I want. Yeah. Right. And they're looking for that.
It's getting it.
And it's highly marketable. Right. Like to say, oh, this is the cure. This is the snake oil. Take these liver pills, intermittent fasting, carnivore diet, ketogenic or whatever. And it just gives them an excuse to,
be
excessive and go for the dopamine hits within some parameters. I wanted to talk a little bit with you about context, because the messaging for a lot of this stuff, especially now, I mean, dude, mm-hmm. when we were growing up, my dream, I knew I wanted to be a strength coach after pro baseball. I'm like, if I could just get a job where I could make a living and train athletes all day, like that would be wonderful. I would love that. And strength coaches, they were kind of like PE coaches that also had a ticket to the game and could get cool access upfield.
Yeah.
And now the entire game has changed. Yeah. Like you can be a millionaire in the fitness industry. You can reach so many people. And so you start to see this influx. And there's always been garbage, but now the garbage is deafening. Like the garbage is deafening online. And every time we get messages from people saying, hey, you think I should get this genetic test? Or I saw this thing that Gary Brecka was talking about. I'm like, oh my God, you got to do the basics right, dude.
Are you
putting
rice in their diet? Yeah. And they're like, this guy said that brown rice will kill me, or the white rice. And they're like, God, eat the fucking rice.
Are you sure the Brussels sprouts aren't going to give me cancer? Give us a little spiel on just the context of this stuff, so you help people understand. Because I think that it's not that the information is categorically false, but what's missing is the context of the information.
Context is everything, and I'll start this off with a brief conversation I had with our friend Zach Evanesh years ago, and he had said, I forget, I think we were grabbing coffee, we were just talking about the industry, right, and how it's changed, and he said, you know, when I got into this 20 or so years ago, so maybe in the 90s, early 2000s, he said, our job was telling people what to do. He says, now our job is telling people what not to do because they're so inundated with so much information that is fatally flawed. So when you say context is everything. And we adhere to the KISS principle, like keep it simple. Silly, we'll say, instead of stupid, we try and be a little more positive. But the most simple approach to start is always the best approach when it comes to nutrition. And nutrition is the easiest one. And I've been ranting on this since, you know, Mark's show and Sean's show and other the shows I did a few weeks ago or so, and a little bit more on my own channel. Humans have literally been eating since the species emerged. When was that? Hundreds of thousands, millions of years. Nobody even knows, but we've literally been eating every day. So we have a lot of data.
Kind of have to, right?
A good sample size to draw from.
Pretty good. And yeah. I don't need some lab coat pencil neck to take six obese women, run them through some sort of self-reported study to then tell me how nutrition actually works. Because a lot of the studies or just with these obese 6, 12, 30 obese, untrained, regular old folks self-reporting. And that's what's being pushed as quote science. So we embrace science, but we do not follow science in that science follows us. And I've said this for a long time. Science has said what I've done at the elite level with these athletes is impossible. And I laugh. I simply say the scientists are standing on the beach. I'm the one who's riding the wave. They don't understand what we're doing out here, and they won't know until we get to the beach and explain to them exactly what happened. Science is 20, 30 years behind, I think, what's happening in elite athletics right now, and that's not their fault. They're just in the labs and in the classrooms. They're not on the playing field. They don't even know the questions to ask. Not bashing them, because there is a place for it. But when we talk about context, and I'll make it very simple, we know what the longest living humans on the planet eat and have eaten since the dawn of time. We know what the greatest performing athletes with the longest ranging careers eat. And we know so for the entirety of their careers. What is that? That is ideally a single ingredient, whole food, multi-meal, omnivorous program, right? Yeah. They're eating 3 to 5 meals of whole foods spread evenly throughout the day with individual variability based upon culture and geography and sport specific. But in general, 3 to 5 meals of a whole foods evenly spread throughout the day. That's what both of those demographics eat, right? Camille, when you were training, were you eating one meal a day? Were you fasting? Were you doing carnivore, right?
No, it was exactly that. It was, you know.
Well, you know, Mike, with enough red light therapy, we could faster for 3 days and then get the autophagy to occur. And then
autophagy.
But it was that. It was, and it wasn't like, because this is the other thing I see a lot of women I work with is like they try to like make up like meals, like of, you know, oh, I had this salad with hummus and sauce, and I made my sauce high in protein, and then I had chicken. And I'm like, no. It was like, you know, when I was peak performance, it was steak, rice, like avocado and peppers. And that's a variation of that I would eat for every meal. Yeah. And, you know, something more easily digestible before my morning session, just because I had my morning session was always the longer one. So I couldn't have something sit in my stomach like that. But I eat the same now.
Yeah.
Just different proportion because I don't need as much fuel.
And there's never one right answer. I feel like a lot of these things you kind of see and hear, it's like some vitriolic statement to get people scared usually.
But you're right with the...
And then they'll say... But I have the answer, and now buy my thing.
You're so right, though, with, you know, a lot of the science on the side. I think they're finally starting, you know, having someone like Rod Schoenfeld, who does a lot of study, and he has a big background in the field itself. Like, you know, what he's coming out with is very interesting, and I do trust that a lot more than, you know, it would be a lot of the science that are coming from are too... The data are a little too chosen sometimes, I think. And the other thing is, it would be the same thing as me going to someone who's, oh, I've been coming to watch you compete at the CrossFit game for 10 years. I know what you need. It's like, get out of here. Like, what, show me your repertoire of champion or, you know, whatever. Like, what is, no, you don't know what I need. Like you coming to tell me that, like, I need to get better at the strongman. Yeah, no shit. Yeah, like, I know that. And trust me, like, I've been working on it as hard as I can.
Mike, you mentioned some stuff about disproving science and how it's behind the curve a lot. And gosh, boy, is there a difference between book knowledge and street knowledge.
Yeah.
Right? That's honestly, I don't even call it the difference between information and actual real knowledge. As a practitioner, as having lived it, right? And you notice, you just know what works, like, because you've seen it.
Yes.
You've fucked up before, you've had success before, you start to see what works. And one thing that we've noticed is, you know, for what we're doing, all right? Yes, a lot of our folks, they want to live their longest, best life. They want to thrive. They want to look awesome. They want to perform well. But it generally falls into this recomposition category.
Yep.
Right. I would like more muscle mass. I would like to reduce body fat. And I know that it's been widely advertised from the scientific community. Oh, you can't reduce body fat and gain muscle mass at the same time. Those are antagonistic signals in the body. You're talking about a catabolic signal and an anabolic signal.
Yeah.
But we have the DEXA scans to prove with a large series of athletes that with the right type of strategy, with what you're eating, when you're eating, and how much you're eating, you can absolutely do that. You can absolutely balance the anabolic signals and the catabolic signals. And one of the ways we do that is by, no matter who you are, at some level, you wake up in the morning and you do your daily fasted cardio. I know that you're a fan of that stuff. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that. And you know, we kind of talk a little bit about the science, about, hey, this is why we're doing what we're doing. But to see somebody, and that's really why you jumped out at me, I'm like, Mike does exactly what we do. He understands this shit. Well, a little bit about that, Mike. I'm like, just getting up and moving around to try to stimulate some glucagon and hold composition.
Well, we do what works, right? And I want to just touch on something Camille had said is, you know, Brad Schoenfeld, who I think is great, and he puts a lot of great scientific research out there, but most of what Brad puts out with respect is what we've already known. So
yeah.
He simply publishes papers that maybe show the mechanism of what we already know. So there's nothing new. I haven't seen anything new come out in the last 30, 50 years from a nutrition science perspective that is any different from what athletes were doing at the turn of the 20th century in the early 1900s. And I've studied those athletes from combat athletes all the way to bodybuilders and strongmen and strength athletes from the 1800s, early 1900s, the advent of anabolic steroids in the maybe 30s or 40s to the golden era of bodybuilding in the Reg Park, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bill Pearl kind of era, like all the way through 80s, 90s, like all the way through today. There is almost nothing new that the silver era bodybuilders were doing that athletes are doing today outside of food availability and access to supplements and some other things.
If anything, maybe they found a way to validate some of the things that they've been doing. For instance, the muscle protein synthesis study that just came out saying, hey guys, we're wrong.
Yeah.
40 grams is not the limit. Like, of course it's not. We're sitting down eating 80 grams of protein after a workout. The fuck, we've been doing this forever.
Yeah. Whoever, and that's like, nobody ever believed that. You didn't, I didn't know.
People would say, you're just pissing it out. You're pissing it. You're pissing away your supplements.
Yeah. And it's like, show me the research from that. How the fuck do you know how much protein am I peeing right now?
Yeah.
Like, that makes no sense, because that's not even what you measure. Yeah, I agree 100% with you. I think what I'm happy about is that finally there's something about the science community that is in line and not just, you know, still
they're validating what we've already known, and in a way trying to take credit for inventing it.
Yeah.
And I find that to be dishonorable.
And I feel like they do it backwards, Mike. You mentioned this. They kind of start with a study to try to come up with an answer instead of doing what science is supposed to do, which is observe what happens in nature and try to figure out why it is that way.
Yeah. Like,
why is steak? Why do all these bodybuilders do so well with steak and eggs? Yeah. Right. What is it about that? What is it about that combination? What if, like, from the training perspective? Right. I mean, you remember Arnold Schwarzenegger talking about the pump.
Yeah.
You know, what is that? Oh, it's metabolic stress. It's creating this cellular swelling. There's an anabolic component to it. Instead of just saying, well, the optimal range is 8 to 12 reps. You know, like, it's kind of backwards in a lot of cases.
Which makes no sense, because if you just look at training in general.
You had touched on, I want to like cover this briefly, and I want to just pull it up so I have it in front of us here, that you had talked about the fasted cardio.
Yes.
And here's something that's interesting, that the scientific community is saying that and continues to say there is no difference between fasted and fed cardio.
Yes.
Basing this on two studies, one of which was produced by Dr. Brad Schoenfeld and Alan Aragon, who I'm friends and I like Alan. Yep. The study that Alan and Brad had posted, they said, hey, there's no difference because there's no significant difference between the two. But when we look at the study that Brad and Alan put out, we see that the fasted cardio group lost 1% more body fat than the fed group.
Yeah.
But due to scientific word speak, word jumble, they say, well, it's not significant, therefore we're not going to report it. Now, you and I both know, Camille, you competing at 1% body fat or light body fat lighter and leaner at the same muscle mass
An
endurance event or a gymnastics event or a pull-up event is huge. We work with Galen Rupp. Galen Rupp won the bronze medal in the 2016 Olympics in the marathon. Okay? He was running out of the Oregon project for Nike. They brought us in to do his nutrition. We did a complete analysis and we looked over, wow, this is pretty amazing. What the goal was for us to reduce Galen's body fat percentage by 1%. So Galen could then run the average mile 5 seconds faster based upon the thermic output of his body heat and calorie and consumption and energy substrate utilization. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of reconfiguring the wind resistance on his torso, right? Yeah. 1% difference in body fat percentage on Galen Rupp got him from the end of his career about to retire to standing on an Olympic podium. How is that not significant? 1% difference between a UFC athlete. You want to talk about a game of inches. This is a game of millimeters and split second reaction time. How about now? And this was over, I believe, a six week period. Let's say 6 weeks. Now, if I can go from let's say, you know, the average person A goes from 15% to 14% body fat in 6 weeks, but I go from 15% to 13. I lost 1% more. Now 12 weeks. Now 24 weeks, now 48 weeks, now a lifetime. So how can such studies say there's no significant difference when you know as an elite athlete, I know as training elite athletes, every elite athlete I know and speak to, and that's hundreds to thousands, I know with very high specificity exactly how they train, how they eat, and every one of them follows the protocol we discuss, not the protocols the scientists say actually work.
Absolutely.
That's insane. And there's another study that was reported that I actually did a video on, was the effects of 6 weeks of fasted aerobic exercise on body shape. And, you know, it goes on. It's posted on my YouTube page. I can send you that. In this study, it was a 6 week period of time. They said that the scientists reported no statistical difference, no significant difference. Yet this group of fasted athletes, participants, lost 2% body fat in a 6 week period of time. So,
and that's a lot in 6 weeks. You know what I mean? Like if you're talking about somebody with 10% body fat, right? You're talking about 20% of their body fat in 6 weeks.
As compared to 10% of the control group.
Yeah.
That is significant. So it's like, it's almost as if, and not like it's like bashing on the scientists, they rally their wagons and they circle a topic and they don't break rank. Now, I know a lot of them individually, probably like you do. Yeah. They are so scared of being ousted inside the community, kind of like what we saw
They're afraid to make statements that they maybe instinctually know, maybe true, right? And I think that's it for us. It's like, maybe I don't know exactly the mechanisms of the body that make this so effective, but what I do know is it works. And even this is a great example. Like, we could talk about the hormones and stimulating glucagon and all that stuff, but if you think even beyond the science into maybe the lifestyle psychological component.
Yes.
You're getting up and you're moving.
Yeah.
You're pushing the food back. Right? Yeah. Like you're delaying the so it's easier for you to maybe hit your calories that day because you're pushing the food back. That in itself is effective, right? Maybe it's not based on, you know, as much of drawing from this study or that study, but if it works, it works. And I think that's what people, they like it when it fits into a box. I don't think that's how it's not A plus B doesn't always equal C, especially with training and nutrition. What worked for you before may not work for you again, but that process of prescribe, assess, and adjust is how you're able to get over that, right? Another subject that we really love talking about is the nutrient timing, right? And you know, when we're doing recomposition stuff with people, we try to place a majority of their calories and a majority of their carbohydrates around their intense training session, because we want them going into these sessions with, you know, enough glucose for their muscles to dispose of that glucose and actually use it instead of storing it. And then post-workout, we'd like to create an insulin spike so they have a better chance of uptaking nutrients and creating muscle protein synthesis. And then we say, outside of that intense training window, you don't need that many carbs. You really don't. Like you can operate on a lower carbohydrate diet as long as you're not doing very expensive glycolytic high-powered activity. It's not going to really hurt you. I wanted to know maybe your opinion on this stuff or how you've leveraged it in the past.
Yeah. I agree with everything you said. And when we're working with the athletes that are getting closer to competition, we are very strategic with carbohydrate ingestion. We want to eat a certain type of carbs at a certain amount to fuel them for a certain time period, especially as we're getting closer to that touchdown point to the scale and then rehydration. We need enough glucose to keep the body running, keep their brain working, keep all the systems, you know, running at high capacity while not shutting things down or sending counter signals to the body that they're approaching some sort of deficit or starvation or detriment or, you know, deficiency, right? So we want to, I never say we hack the body or trick the body. We're working with the body, knowing the body as well as we can, giving the body everything it needs to adapt in the direction we want it to go, right? So we're clearing the path in a certain direction that the body will follow that way. When we talk about more of the general body composition clients, I agree that we want to fuel the athlete or the client with ample carbohydrate to be stored as glycogen, reserved for glycolytic expression later on. Because we know that the brain needs glucose and general activity needs a little bit of glucose. We need some stored glycogen. Now, none of us will ever know how much glycogen you or I or anyone else stores, but we can estimate, especially with a little experience, 3 to 10 days working with a client, we can tell pretty well how they're feeling, how they're performing, what they're weighing, what their composition looks like, if they're holding water, how it's digesting, what their bowel movements even are starting to, you know, progress towards. So we can make a pretty good estimation early on. And we know, hey, perfect, you're eating 5 meals a day. We're giving you, let's say, 30 grams of carbohydrates per meal. On average, pre and post workout, we might bump that up a little bit based upon their insulin sensitivity, based upon their current body composition, based upon the type of activity they will be performing, right? Glycolytic activity in the gym, a little bit more, you know, sugar, let's say beforehand, more of an endurance type of event, little bit less, little bit, maybe a higher fat type of ingestion going into that. So we're more, you know, substrate specific in what they'll utilize during the event itself too. And then post event, how are we recovering based upon what we've depleted, but also thinking about what are they going to need into the next block? Now, I like to say we're always thinking 2 to 4 hour increments, but then we want to expand that into 12 hour and 36 hour and 72 hour. In 72 hours, I want to make sure we're getting all of the vital micronutrition we need in that big 72 hour block. And we're aware of some of that glycogen storage. But then as we move into like the 12-hour block and the 2 to 4 hour block, are we preparing that athlete from a recovery capacity, enough ample amino acids to enhance muscle protein synthesis or the re-glycogenation of the muscle cells in the liver itself, so they have some of their pantry is full, let's say. And then we have some of that more short-term energy available readily in the bloodstream if they're going to be up and active, or not so much if they're just going to be sitting on the deck, you know, splashing in the pool with the kids, right? We want to pull that down a little bit, especially if body composition matters. And I think it should. All of them.
I mean, it should always matter, you know? Like one of the things we say is that elite athletes look like elite athletes, you know? And whatever your goal is, tell me how it wouldn't be benefited by having a little bit more muscle and a little bit less excess body fat to carry around. But just kind of speaking to what you were saying, that's another thing we've observed is that like there's also a tremendous amount of customization that can sometimes occur with regard to carbs, because everyone's got a different level of carbohydrate sensitivity. Yeah. There's some people just genetically, you give them a little bit of carbs, they just blow up and they don't have a tolerance for it. And there are some people that like me, I can blast through 700 grams of carbs and still hold composition. And there's the only way to figure that out is to go through that weekly process of doing your check-ins, doing your weigh-ins, you know, getting that evaluation, because so much of this stuff, the principles are set, but the specifics are highly individualized. Like what percentage of protein and carbs and fat you actually need, that can vary to some degree, but the idea of having some level of carbohydrate restriction is certainly going to be universal with regard to just recomposition. The other thing I want to bring up, Mike, is like, you're such an experienced guy, right? And you can tell we jam out on the science. And I love that we're talking about the cellular signals, the physiology and the hormones and all that stuff. But when you do your educational videos online, you do such a great job of very elegantly distilling something that's inherently complex in a palatable way for your athletes. And that's something you see a lot of like rookie coaches, they kind of recite the textbook and everyone's like, oh, the big words, that sounds good. Yeah. But like, I love the way that you can take something that, you know, most people it's over their head and just say, hey, bro, here's what you need to know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I forget who it was. It might've been Einstein who had said, if you cannot explain it to a 5-year-old, you do not understand it. And that stands out. Now back, I had mentioned, you know, working as a municipal tax assessor, which is a political position. And in that position, it was my job to work with, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations and their you know, highly sophisticated legal teams. And then also the 86-year-old farmer who didn't even have a high school education. And they would come and sit in my office and I would have to explain the complexities of real estate tax law and the impact on their specific situation. And I'm very fortunate to have had that experience because I knew what I said had to be communicated in a manner that the person in front of me could receive. Now, I also was an expert witness in the Supreme Court testifying to real estate valuations and taxation. So the way I speak was highly scrutinized by state Supreme Court judges and attorneys and everyone in between, real estate appraisers. The simplicity of speech is the most powerful.
Yeah.
And when I put these videos out, I am speaking to the average person that simply wants to look better, feel better, live better. And I understand all the scientists are just waiting to get to trip me up.
Oh, yeah. they know the wrong word.
I used to worry, like earlier in my career, I used to worry about that. So I didn't talk as much because I was always like, oh, maybe I'm going to mispronounce that word, or, am I really 100%, triple checked on the exact mechanism here, because I don't want this PhD asshole to do a follow-up video and say, oh, Dolce is wrong simply because he mispronounced a word. He was slightly out of whack with the Krebs cycle or whatever stupid thing it might be. And finally, I was like, wait a minute, I am a fucking master of my craft. I know this stuff inside and out. And more so than the academia, I know how to produce results in real time better than almost any scientist I can think of. Not to disrespect them. It's just not what they do.
Yeah, they're playing a different game.
I got a 30-year resume working in elite athletics, producing world champion performances. That is, anyone in the world can just simply go and view it on TV, on the internet, right? So it's my body of work is out there. I can have this conversation. I'll say I produce more world champion athletes than almost any, quote, academic I can think of. So they are pontificating on the stuff I've already done. They can't tell me what I've done is wrong because I have the results here in my hand. So to say that, it's like I have this level of confidence and authority. When I speak, I'm speaking to the proverbial high school graduate that doesn't have a strong grasp of the science, but they're struggling with their own health issues, their own body image issues. And they are so fucking confused by all these a-hole scientist wannabe, where's your data dudes, that they're stuck and don't know what to do. And I want to clear all that up in a very easy to understand, concise, 60 to 90 seconds to make your point, have it validated with a real world takeaway at the end. And I think speaking exactly the way we're speaking right now is how most people want to consume that content. They don't want to hear some academic dissertation by some thumb dick who's trying to pretend how smart he is. Therefore, you better believe him because he's got bigger words than you know how to understand. That doesn't help anybody.
And they can attack you, but they can't attack your results. And that's why, like, we have this tapestry of before and afters behind us. And I'm like, I don't even want to weigh in on my opinion. Tell that to the abs behind me. You know what I mean? Like, that's the ultimate metric. And I think that's where, when you get into these semantical debates or when people say, oh, well, you do this, that, or the other thing. I always tell folks, when you're evaluating a training system, a nutrition system, don't look at the person who's writing it. Look at the athletes who are doing it. Look at the breadth and depth at which they're able to impact, because that is the ultimate metric for evaluating, is this legit or not? Not how you feel about the person delivering the information, or if you want to look like them, or if they're genetically gifted or whatever else they might be doing. That doesn't matter. What matters are the clients. Like, what matters are the results.
Does it work?
That's so helpful to me to hear you say all this stuff, because I think I'm kind of there in my life. Where sometimes I'm scared to put myself out there because I do have a chemical engineering degree. So I come from those specific people. And I'm always scared to not know enough. And it's like, well, I am an expert at what I've done so far. So that helps me get more confidence to just go out there and say what I know. And the other thing I wanted to touch base with the whole scientific community, there's great work out there. But I remember, like, once I won the CrossFit game, all of a sudden I had all those scientists that wanted to test me for this and that, and then, do this new thing, do this next thing. And I'm like, you know where I get good results? By working my ass up and eating well and sleeping well. And that's it. Like, nothing can replace the hunger And nothing can replace, you know, me assessing my own self. And it, there's no amount of like red light therapy that can change just that pure determination and resilience. There's something about that. There's something about that junkyard dog mentality that you just can't teach. You can't science out of. You just can't, I don't know how to say it. It's such a character that like really needs to be earned. So I absolutely agree. There's, you know, red light therapy will help in some case. And that's also where I think as an athlete, you become smarter as you get older because your body doesn't give you as much love when you push it really hard. It doesn't heal as fast. So you develop a lot of knowledge behind, you know, how to heal. But even on that side, I feel like I tried so many things, and at the end of the day, there's a million things to do. And there's like, you know, those 5 or 10 things that I'm like, those work. Yeah. Because they work.
It's also like paralysis by analysis sometimes where you're doing so much, you're like, holy shit, like, don't forget to live your life, right? Like, you've seen these guys, like, I get up at 4 a.m. and I jump in the ice bath and then I meditate. I'm like, this sounds fucking exhausting. Like, what kind of life is just like, just sleep and eat and train, you know? Like,
and when do you work? Yeah. When do you work or spend time with your family?
Mike, tell us a little bit about some of your...
You guys keep going. I have to go. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is super
honestly
fun.
I literally want to go where you live and spend like a month with you and see you training people, and I love learning so much. So I'm like itching to get more out of you. I have to go. Dave is gonna keep going. So I'm very jealous here. But thank you so much.
Absolutely, Camille. It's great to chat, and we'll talk soon. Maybe we'll all do like a meetup. So your place and my place, right?
We'll come on down to Tampa. We'll hang out. We got a killer garage gym set up here. We train down at MI40 gym a lot. And there's a lot of guys. I mean, Lane Norton trains at our gym. We talk shop all the time and laugh about this stuff. He's a little bit more on the science side. So we're constantly, you know, this or that. But dude, I mean, tell us a little bit about where you're at right now and what you see. Like, what are some of your goals moving into the future with the Dolce diet and Dolce fitness? Where do you see this stuff going for yourself? And what is the next thing for you?
Ultimately, I'm here to help. I'm here to help people. And I see myself very much as a servant to all those within my reach. I believe I have the knowledge, the skills, and the passion to help every person on this planet live a better and healthier life. So now it's my job to get that message out as far as I can, so anyone who's stuck and interested that they can hear it and just glean some piece of information that will, you know, be a catalyst for them to move into the next phase of their healthier life. It doesn't matter whether or not they follow my stuff, but maybe I can say something that creates an idea that gets them to take personal accountability or gives them the tools that they need or the confidence they need. So we're just trying to keep just growing our footprint in the amount of humans we can help. And we all run businesses. So, you know, we have different ways that we can, you know, run profitable businesses and create new products and services and monetization and things like that. But that's always secondary to how much value can I add to the community at whole, the larger community? What can I do to help people live better lives? And then the product, service, monetization falls behind that first kind of general goal. And that's the way we've always run our business, which is a blessing. Like, I quit a high-paying job to help these combat athletes become healthier versions of themselves so they could get through the arduous nature of this sport with their brains and bodies intact. And like, yeah. I walked away from a lot of money to devote my life almost like a missionary would, trying to bring this message of nutrition and self-health to this, you know, undiscovered population. And I was just lucky that sport grew and I grew within the sport, and I was able to get this little bit of a footprint maybe in the community. But I was differentiated because of, again, the quality of the work, the results that we had, and the validity to what we were saying. And yeah, we've since been able to grow that more, because now I don't have the desire, probably like you guys, I'm not trying to work with combat athletes anymore. I'm actually not accepting any. I'll do consultations. I'll, hey, pick my brain. Let me workshop, troubleshoot with you. Ask me anything, like all that fun stuff. Yes. But I have no desire to leave my daughters. I want to see their faces in the morning. I want them to see my face at night when I put them to bed. I want to be a part of all those experiences with them right now. But to extend that reach as wide as possible to help people, I mean, through, you know, great shows like yours and kind of networking where it's like, hey, I'm not in Tampa, but man, Dave and Camille, they're down in Tampa. Like, check out their stuff. I am a massive believer in infinite success, that none of this is finite. The more great minds like you guys out there that I can refer out to and push out to and point to, that's what it's about, because it all comes back. Like, the healthier we are, the more we're talking about the real information, the healthy information. We're pushing away the Liver King and the Paul Saladino and all of the hocus pocus, bogus, faux fitness frauds, I like to kind of say. The more we push away that fad diet narrative and we get people back to just living healthy lives, the world is better off. And whatever tiny little piece I can play in that game, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, dude, I love that. It sounds like our missions are so in line, you know, like for us, yes, we run a business, we have employees, we want to make money, we want to be profitable. But for me, the bottom line is breadth and depth of impact, because I feel like if we have a large breadth and depth of impact, a lot of that stuff takes care of itself. It'll be there. That's not the reason for, you know, we want to fuel the machine and spread the message and change lives and, you know, try to help people thrive, because and I'm sure it's the same for you. We have such a passion about this stuff because we lived it. We believe in it. And, you know, Cam talked a little bit about her story, like my story. I got messed up, you know, I've got Crohn's disease. I had a major back surgery. I'm a lifelong athlete. And I got to a point where I was like, man, I really don't like where I'm at right now. Like, this is not doing it for me. And then, you know, you explore these avenues and find these things. And when it impacts you, you want to share that with people. You want to say like, dude, this is what you need. It can help you too. And that's the best reward, is hearing that feedback of like, hey, you know, for the first time in my life, I feel like I got hope again. I'm seeing progress again. I've never felt so good. I've never looked so good. This is so impactful for people in a way you can't even quantify it. You know, like it really is life changing, and that is the lasting story and the lasting legacy. So, dude, it's been great hamming it up with you, man. This is so fun. I hope we get to link up in person sometime. Where can people find you, Mike?
Just The Dolce Diet. That's the great thing. So thedolcediet.com. We have, you know, our online portal there. Instagram, I'm most active on. I understand, I think, the psychology of Instagram. I consume most of my content there, and people seem to enjoy my Instagram reels and page. So it's like The Dolce Diet on Instagram or our .com. Those are the primary hubs to go to. And, you know, you can pretty much find me with a simple Google search.
Awesome. And you said it right there, man. Like, I agree with you. It's not a zero sum game. Like, more for me shouldn't mean less for you. I want to find people in this space that I know and like and believe in, and be able to create that rising tide raises all ships together, because we're all fighting the same fight here, you know, and we're just making the pie bigger. And the more lives we touch, the more people we change, the more transformations, that just builds steam for everybody and starts to elevate the people that are doing the good hard work.
It's true. It's funny that, you know, I study business and other businesses and evergreen principles. And if you think about business, most business sectors are located in the same general vicinity, and most competitors are located right next to each other. There's an intersection not far from here. There is a McDonald's, there is a Burger King, there is a Wendy's, and there is a Chick-fil-A on four corners. Why is that? Because they're all attracting the same basic audience. And they are, quote, competitors are running independent businesses. But when people need food, they're going to one of these places. And each flavor is slightly different for that person in that time on that day. They have a different need maybe in that moment. So it's like I've always believed in the more value I can add to a community or to an individual, the more they're going to trust me later on down the road. So if I say you have to check out Dave and Camille, what they're doing is absolutely incredible. You will love them, their personality, their experience, their work ethic. They live it, they embody it, and look at the results that they have. You got to go and check them out, work with them. Let me know how it goes. They're going to be like, dude, Dolce told me to come and find you. You guys are fucking awesome. That Mike guy, he gave me great value, but and they might never, ever come and find me or work with me or pay me a single dollar. I don't care about that, but it's that transfer of energy and value, and I call it 4D marketing, four dimension, that they'll always become a positive ambassador of myself just as an individual, my word as being honorable, my brand as being value-driven. The more I do that, the better my business is, and I can't work with everybody. There's 8 billion humans on the planet. Lord, I wish I could work with them all, but I can only work with like a speck of sand on a large beach of that amount of people. And Lord knows, you can only work with a few hundred to a few thousand people, let's say. I can only work with the same. There are hundreds of millions of people in this country alone that need our help. So yep. It's like, I'm always trying to find I call them my super friends, a group of people I can point to and be like, you got it. You're a CrossFitter. You have that experience. I don't really speak that culture. I understand training and nutrition. You speak the same language as Dave and Camille. They will fucking fix you up and get you where you need, or whatever that might be. So that type of infinite success, man, that I've never seen someone with a finite mentality grow exponentially. And that comes from all business, you know, all my business mentors, it is infinite. They're always helping other people make money, because maybe you guys would be like, damn, man, that Dolce stuff is great. You should check out what Dolce's doing over there.
Well, I think that's how you create a revolution, you know, like that's honestly how you create that cultural revolution, when you have a lot of good people working together, you know, driving towards the same idea, preaching the same mantra, creating, you know, the same kind of experience. All right, brother, I'll let you go. Short podcast, right? It's going 90 minutes.
Man, so quick. I love it. I really appreciate you. We'll be in touch offline. We'll set something up. I'd love to
hear
you and Camille on my show at some point, maybe individually, because you
both absolutely
have stories and backgrounds, right? So
yeah, we both got pretty interesting stories, you know, in athletics and with training and nutrition and honestly, in you know, from the male perspective, you know, a lot of the people I work with, it's kind of a bit more focused on the men's side of things.
Yeah.
A lot of the people Cammy works with, a lot more focused on the women's side of things, because we've lived it, you know, so we understand, we have the empathy for, you know, what it means to chase that dream, that person you aspire to be.
Yep. I love it. Absolutely, man. So we'll hook up and keep going. Thank you for having me on, brother. I appreciate
you. No, my pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
All right. Talk soon.